Welcome to the Independent Curriculum Group's Partner Podcast. The Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast highlights the work of our partner schools in the development of contemporary education as they embrace and enact the ICG's principles of independent curriculum, which you can find on our homepage at independentcurriculum.org. The Independent Curriculum Group is a consortium of over 150 schools around the world interested in building stronger, more effective programs. The ICG helps schools envision, design, implement, and evaluate school-generated, mission-aligned curriculum. Because independent curriculum is created in individual schools by teachers to serve their very own students, independent curriculum is innovative by definition. We hope that you will find this podcast both interesting and inspiring, and we hope that you will subscribe to our entire Partner Podcast series. Welcome to this episode of the Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the ICG and host of the Partner Podcast. Today we're talking with Dr. Jewel Reuter, Associate Head for Institutional Research, Academic Innovations, and Strategic Relations at the Episcopal School of Baton Rouge in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Jewel, thank you for joining us for the ICG Partner Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. And we're going to be focusing, incidentally, on Jewel's experience. Well, she has wide experience in lots of areas, but particularly interested in her rather unique experience in coping with natural disasters that have had a significant effect on the experience of schools, teachers, and of course students and their families. So Jewel, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to be with you today.
Can you first maybe tell us a little bit about the Episcopal School of Baton Rouge?
Well, with respect to Episcopal's mission and its values, we're basically a ministry of the Episcopal Diocese of Louisiana, and nurturing and developing the whole child is the major focus. And the areas that subdivide out are spiritual, intellectual, moral, physical, and artistic. And we attempt to do that through challenging curriculum and also co-curricular activities. So the focus isn't just on the graduate for college, but it's also for the leading of a purposeful life. We have approximately 970 students from pre-K 3 through 12th grade, and we have about 170 professionals on campus that work towards the learning. And big things that we've been working on is not just providing academics, but working to provide arts, athletics, service, and community leadership. And I think if you would talk to somebody in the community, Episcopal is known for its academic performance, but within that same breath, you would hear something said to the effect that, well, even though the academics is there, there's a balance toward the spiritual life of the students and offering a wide range of opportunities, and those opportunities are to help foster the student finding their own purposeful life.
That's terrific. Thank you. I have to say, I'm always interested in the spiritual life of schools, and since most of my work has been in very secular schools, I still am a firm believer that there is a huge spiritual component that is has nothing to do with religious denomination and has everything to do with the way students learn to believe in their worlds and in themselves.
So. I think that is a very inclusive and diverse approach, Peter, that you've described, and I would say that our diverse community would feel very comfortable with that articulation.
Well, thank you. And how did you come to be at the Episcopal School of Baton Rouge? Can you tell us a little bit about your path to your school and the work that you're doing there right now?
Well, I do think I was somewhat driven by a little bit of a disaster, believe it or not, in my destiny to here at Episcopal. I started off in my education career at Tulane University as an undergraduate in biochemistry, and then along the way I did a Master's of Arts of Teaching and had many years at Jesuit High School in New Orleans, where I learned at that point from, in particular, participation in the Woodrow Wilson Foundation at Princeton for a month, that I had a calling not only to educating teachers, but also emerging and developing education program and working in professional development, which was part of the Woodrow Wilson paradigm of the fellowship that I had. So upon my return from Woodrow Wilson, a summer at Princeton, I started to work with programs and teacher professional development that I decided I wanted to get depth of knowledge with a PhD in curriculum and instruction. So I was fortunate to begin my studies and complete my studies in human constructivism, which is very much rooted in personalization of learning, taking students step by step, taking students step by step in their actual learning. So in the process, I finished a PhD in 2005, and well, that May, and then by that August, evacuated to Baton Rouge for the Hurricane Katrina. And from that point, I worked with the Diocese of New Orleans recovering the schools there, and also with the Louisiana Virtual School, which I had worked with through college or through graduate school, that provided me the opportunity to be able to help with the recovery both on the ground in the schools and also actually online, which was became part of the theme. And so I finished that recovery by 2010, and that's when I started at Episcopal School of Baton Rouge, which was an opportunity that I had because they were interested in personalizing and advancing their academics from good to great. And so with my background, I was able to come and work with the head of school here and the administration and move forward those sorts of initiatives.
That's quite a path. Here at the ICG, we of course believe that educational innovation and mission-aligned school-created curriculum are the keys to the future of learning. But first of all, we have to make sure that school is actually happening and that everyone involved in the school community is safe. So I'm wondering if you could speak then a little bit about the situation that you all found yourselves at in Baton Rouge a year or so ago when the floods came.
Well, Peter, we were actually on our very first day of class. We had had orientation the day before, a faculty and also a faculty kickoff party for the accreditation that we were getting to the conclusion of during that academic year. And so we went home and had no clue that it would start raining the next morning and that it would keep raining. And so that rain just kept coming, and north of us it rained a lot harder. I think we had a total of 42 inches of rain over a certain amount of time, and so our
wow.
campus started to flood that Saturday night. So we canceled school that Friday thinking, oh boy, it was really a bad weather day and we didn't want to have the children in the flooding. Street flooding seemed to be a possibility. So by that Saturday night, the school started taking on water, and not only did the school start taking on water, we had faculty taking in water, and so all of a sudden we started to have a pretty dramatic situation unfolding in the front of us as far as our not just the school but our community.
Wow. Well, it seems to me that there are kind of four phases to thinking about disaster planning. First, there's preparation, as much as one can do. Then comes just getting through the crisis as it unfolds and discovering the things that you didn't necessarily plan for. And then third, there's figuring out what happened and getting the program back together in the moment. And fourth, there's hindsight, looking back for lessons learned and using these to improve the planning process for next time, knowing that whatever happens next probably will be different in some way. So maybe we should walk through these one at a time. So you brought with you to Episcopal School of Baton Rouge your own experiences from New Orleans during Katrina and its aftermath. What kinds of planning were you able to do at Episcopal School since you're kind of in what has become Hurricane Ground Zero, more often than not, as this very rapid flooding disaster unfolded. I'm thinking especially about planning that might keep the academic program from washing away completely.
Well, and that's true. I think, you know, Baton Rouge had served as the dry part for New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and so for it, the flood was certainly not quite in the expectations. But we had, at Episcopal School of Baton Rouge, had begun something called the emergency closure lesson. And so that was part of what I had learned from Hurricane Katrina, was that, and if taking a look at the levels of disasters, in a one-day type of thing where you're only shutting down school for one day, or something less than a semester, or something greater than a semester that causes a lack of campus use, if we're talking in terms of a, you know, traditional school. So with that in mind, we had taken a, at Episcopal School of Baton Rouge, you know, realizing that, well, maybe a 1 day, 2 day, 3 day, maybe a 4 day closure, maybe up to a 2 week type of closure due to power loss was maybe more of a situation that we would maybe be in. In context, again, maybe a hurricane like Katrina or Gustav that sort of, you know, swiped either near the city or over the city. Mm-hmm. And so we started in something that I had started to do in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina with the Archdiocese of New Orleans school system, which is about 118 schools, that if we had a learning management system in place. And so having a learning management system in place allowed us to have be robust in our use of flipped classroom and different applications, having classes running when we weren't necessarily having the teacher and the student available. So a learning management system was one of the resource items that we had on the tool list that we were looking at investing in. And so in the process of investing in it, one of the very first things that we did with it was something called the emergency closure lesson, which every teacher created 3 days of lessons that could be ready in the portal where it could have emergency closure lesson consistently located for all the students and families to be able to find. And so we were able to establish that, and faculty were able to use our learning management system in the way they felt that they wanted to use it. But the one thing that we came to some campus-wide decision was to utilize it for this emergency closure lesson. And the emotional intelligence on it was high because faculty understood. We had, I mean, again, Baton Rouge has been through a moderate number of power outages, let's say, that were associated with storms and things of that sort, or, you know, closures due to ice or something like that, which the city doesn't deal very well with. And everybody wants the students to continue learning. And so we were able to do that. But then we had a fire drill for it, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
We had an emergency closure lesson drill, and we gave everybody a 2 week period of time to run their lesson and have students actually do at least a mock lesson that would take maybe if they wanted a very small 5 minute type of thing or whatever they were up for, but having them log in and be able to get into the system and be able to actually get to the lesson, do the lesson, submit the lesson, which a learning management system allowed for, and also the teacher could give it back to the student and have comments, and we had the email running so that faculty felt that they could have this type of feedback. Again, learning management, not just a way of providing some sort of a correspondence course or something like that, but giving it some feeling that it was not exactly the same as a face-to-face day, but it would work us to be able to continue that motion of learning. And so we did have all that in place, but you know, as you were saying, what do you do for the unexpected? Well, we did have the unexpected. You know, the unexpected was teachers had the lessons ready, but we didn't have the students quite into the system exactly. They had access, but we always had set an emotional intelligence across the campus that the families and the teachers and the students understood, is that, well, sure, you may have power outage, you have your own particular emergency situation that you have to deal with, and that if there is a problem and you're not able to access this learning resource, we will take care of that on a case-by-case basis upon our return or in some other way. So we all felt, I have to say, that the comfort, we had been using this emergency lesson for a few other problems that we have had. We had a tornado not too long ago that didn't hit the school, but that was nearby, that caused us to have a power outage for a few days. I guess it was back in 2015, we were down on power for about 3 days, actually, on campus.
Wow.
And we were able to run our emergency closure lesson and keep things running because it was an isolated problem that the area that the school was in was experiencing, but the rest of Baton Rouge was running pretty well. So we had a definite feeling, well, wow, if we only had that running, but we also did know that we had it there available to run if we needed to, and if our students did need to, and if we did need to utilize it. For example, Hurricane Katrina. If the schools in New Orleans had already had that running, but again, in 2005, there were learning management systems, but it wasn't as easy to manage. Faculty weren't really trained for such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was something that I learned from Hurricane Katrina that we started to do here. But that was something that we weren't able to actually utilize fully at that time. But there were quite a few other, utilizations that there were other resources that we could ultimately utilize, as we'll take a look at some other things in a few minutes.
So, and the LMS then, because it's hosted not on campus, is presumably available to, if you have internet service, you can access the LMS.
If you have internet service, you can access the LMS.
Yeah.
And now that the LMS is very mobile friendly, okay, usually people can, and the students also know that they can access, for the most part, even on, it's possible to get the lessons in a cellular format if necessary also.
So I'm interested, I see a lot of conversations on listservs about which LMS, and that certainly becomes an important criterion, that mobile friendliness and offsite hostedness, that's important. So,
yeah, I think I agree, Peter, and we've been through two now. So, and one of the reasons we migrated from Blackboard to Canvas actually is because Blackboard was having it wasn't as mobile friendly as Canvas was. So, and our middle school functions off of iPads, which requires more of a mobile application. But yeah, so there's a lot of issues involved there. But at least for our community, and even for the Archdiocese of New Orleans, feeling that there was a way of being able to get a connection, even if students had to go to a library, let's say, or, use. The fact of the matter is, the emotions of having students have the option and families feeling like they're able to continue the learning and the connection to the school was so significant in both Hurricane Katrina and also in this flood of 2016 that we had here in Baton Rouge, that that the families and the connection that we provided, that even though there could be some stress associated with such a tool available, it seemed as though people were very willing to take the good that was coming from it. There was a certain amount of comfort that came from the fact that we could still stick together as something as important as a school.
I think that's really interesting and really important, and I'm not sure that we're used to thinking of learning management systems and emotional intelligence kind of in the same thought process. But I'm thinking about this and how how schools get through these. And as other places have been experiencing this year's storms and fires, mm-hmm. you know, Baton Rouge during the flooding had different parts of your community affected differently, from places that were experiencing full washouts when you and I were talking about this, to places that just, you know, lost power, to places that experienced relatively low levels of damage. And then you had the campus, which also suffered, you know, from different parts of the campus suffered in varying degrees. And so, as I've been thinking about this, you know, was there ever a time, and this ties into that emotional importance and the idea of being able to connect to the school, when the Episcopal School of Baton Rouge kind of ceased to exist as a working institution? Or were there always threads and pieces of the culture, you know, digitally or otherwise, that really kept the community of learners intact? It seems to me it's as important to keep the idea of the school going as much as it is to keep the work happening.
Well, Peter, I have to say, as you're just recanting that situation, I get shivers across my body from a standpoint of having experienced this twice now, from a standpoint of, you know, like, you know, are we going to be able to pull it together? Are we going to be able to make it work? And, you know, the threat is so great when you have homes devastated, especially the similarities that we've experienced recently between Hurricane Katrina, the Great Flood of 2016, Harvey, Maria. You know, these events, they unfold very often. It's not as quick as a tornado by no means. I mean, the flooding and the devastation taking across the cities and, you know, and causing these problems that, and once the school is involved, I have to say that I think that for some of our families and sincerely would have offered up their own house instead of a dry house would have taken a dry school. That to them, being able to provide a school experience for their student, their child, and not just that, because, I mean, independent schools provide so much more than just the academics. I'm fully confident of that across my experience with NAIS. And so our situation was that we had, fortunately, Hugh McIntosh, our head of school, did have a dry house, okay. And so, and he had taken in some of our administrators, actually, and so it became a little easier in a way to have a what we call it an administrative council meeting to some extent, which that not everybody could actually attend, but the board chair was able to, you know, get to Hugh McIntosh's house, and a few of the other administrators were able to get there, and we had adequate enough technology that he was able to Skype out and broadcast, and also record for the community a state of decision for Episcopal School of Baton Rouge, which at that point was still under some floodwaters. But we were relatively confident that it was a moderate amount of flooding to about 30% of the campus. So with a moderate amount of flooding, about 30% of the campus, not too sure about how long it was going to take the water to recede exactly, because that quite didn't happen yet, that he, along with the board chair, had come to a conclusion that 2016 school year would not be defined by the flood, that we would pull together and provide the year that each student deserved, because they would only be in that grade 1 year. And so that our goal at that point was to take a look at and really embrace hard, first off, the data to find out what is available, what was damaged, what sorts of things that we had to do, what sorts of communication had to be made, and how accurate those communications had to be, the carefulness of creating communication that was realistic, not overly optimistic or pessimistic, to be able to be realistic about where we were and to keep everybody, for the most part, with their composure with everything that was happening. a survey was critical in the process to not just, I mean, for us to get a spread of what was going on in the community, because communication was relatively thin at that point with respect to the media and everything else, which is usually what happens. You can learn more on CNN sometimes than you can learn locally in the process of some of these things. So that we were able to get the surveys out, get the impact at every level to our community, both the families and the students, along with our, you know, our faculty, our staff, our operational crew, all the pieces that we had to put together. And our administrative council is just a magical group of people in my mind, in a way, because we get together and it's not just the division heads and associate head, working with academics and athletics. We include our facilities operation director also, and he has got an amazing awareness for what he does on this campus with respect to how it impacts the learning. And one of his quick calls from the very start was have ServPro to dry the place out, so that before the water receded, we were already had our request in to be able to have ServPro get to the campus to help us with drying as much as possible. And so the days went by, and we were able to map the damage to the school after that Tuesday or so, the water started to recede at the school as it started to flood other areas that were more downstream. And we had more faculty that lost their houses to the water a few days later. I think the flooding lasted for about 6 days total, which after some of the hurricanes recently and Hurricane Katrina, the water stayed for 21 days. So, all these sorts of things are kind of part of the storm, is riding through the emotion of these various things that have to happen. So we realized at that point that ServPro was great to have in line, and that we were able to have boots on the ground with cleaning the school. And our athletic department, our philelectic department, had some students who had dry houses and were looking to help. And because our community is united, which we learned from this whole event, that our people were coming forward to help each other in need. And we had some dry houses, we had some people not affected, a reasonable number, and so they went and started to rip sheetrock out of faculty houses, and they started to rip sheetrock out of student houses and try to help get the recovery back to the point where we could start to look at maybe being able to open the school again by being able to have people come back to the school because they had enough a place to live, food to eat, all these different things that we had to think about. But because of the nature of our community and the fact that we did have some dry spots, I think similar to Houston, and I think sometimes, the devastation is not totally inclusive of an entire area, that understanding what your resources are really important at that point, to be able to get back the school if you can. And for us, it was a matter of mapping out the relocation of the buildings that had been flooded, that we could actually find space on our 55-acre campus in other buildings. Was it possible for us to do a domino of displacements and find halls and different places that were really suitable to learning? And that's where we all came to this harvest, I would call it, of academic emotional intelligence from our faculty, some of the collaborative projects we were working on, because our lower school was flooded, and all of a sudden we were using our visual and performing arts building for, like, our large choir room became one of our grade levels, and we were able to divide it into three sections for each of the three classes. The teachers were able to do some joint lessons together at times. They were able to rotate their teaching and have enough patience to be able to make that work in a meaningful way, and having parents embrace the actually advanced pedagogy that we had the opportunity to pull forward in a more intense way. So the families voted in the survey that it wasn't too hard to get their children to school. That if we could get the school up and running 7 days later, or I guess it was we were closed for 6 school days, which put us, I guess that was a total of 10 days after the flood, including our weekends, we were able to open the school again. And that was a Monday morning that we were able to bring our students back in after a Saturday, a previous Saturday flood week previous to that. And we had, like, I guess 90% of our students, a good 90-95% were there that day. And our faculty, we were able to bring in an entire faculty. But with the type of situation where we had substitutes on duty, that if any of our faculty had to leave at any time to take care of a personal matter, that we could bring in a substitute because we didn't want to put upon our faculty. But they wanted to come back, and many of them had their own children. That was driving part of their desire, their feeling to want to be back to normal and be with their children. That they teach at school, which is as good as their own, which is as important as their own family. So we had families that brought food for the faculty because they knew that many of our faculty couldn't cook. They didn't have a kitchen. And so we had resources of people coming forward with trucks of food. People came from Houston, actually. We had one family that had their father and mother came from Houston with a catering that had part of a catering company facility that was able to come and help feed our faculty to be able to bring back food home at that night. You know, our chef was able to get back to be able to provide lunch. So we were able to pull all those pieces together in a meaningful way to be able to start school within a time frame that was, I would say, probably faster than I could have ever imagined the day that we began the flood, all for the sake of uniting the school to bring back everybody so that our children could have an experience of every day that they could possibly have in the classroom. But also, the other part of it that was entangled, and obviously so to some extent, since we're a whole child school, is that the athletic component of the school is very important to the education that every student gets. We have 89% of our students in extracurricular activities, in particular in athletics. 89% participate in athletics, at least one sport. And so all of our fields were flooded. And so we had worked out cooperations during the flood to be able to use other facilities that were not on our 55-acre campus, which impacted our academics. And so we had cooperation in the middle school and upper school that where faculty understood that they needed to make a difference in the type of homework that they gave, that they had to reevaluate the type of assignments that they were giving to try to minimize the stress that these students were undergoing, because we as a community decided that every football game counted just as much as every test in a classroom, and that if we could possibly provide that type of opportunity to our students in every volleyball game and all the other things that we had to transport students to another location for, that we could do it if we all put our heads together. And so homework had been something we were working on for a few years. Our students tended to get lots of homework. And so we rethought the homework a little bit as systematically, and were able to cooperate with the students who never complained at all. And that was part of that's a little bit of a problem in itself. When they get too tired, they don't say anything. So I think we were able to pull it together, but it was every piece of the campus is involved in the actual learning of what's going on.
So another thing that you had mentioned when we spoke earlier was that your schedule, you were able to figure out ways to use the schedule and to kind of make up for some of the time that had been lost to the flood.
Well, and Peter, that was the thing that we were actually trying to avoid with the emergency closure lesson options that we had set forward. But as usual, again, having a backup plan, and part of it, knowing that for our particular school day, which is from 7:50 to 3:20, we have quite a bit of time built in that's not just the traditional classes, including advisory and chapel and tutorial. And so what we were able to do is, with the cooperation of everyone, we were able to, knowing the number of minutes that we had, we were able to, over approximately 6 to 8 weeks, take our chapel time, our advisory time, our parts of the tutorial time, and restructure it so that we were able to gain back all the days, the minutes of the days that we had lost. We had 3 days built in. Our calendar, what we usually do is build in an extra 3 or 4 days of instructional time as a just-in-case situation. But we always try to use our emergency closure lesson, and this was an example of where we went beyond our 3 days and went into the minutes, extra minutes that we had built into our calendar. In all three divisions, we had extra minutes built in beyond the 3 days, meaning that we would forego some of our whole child experience temporarily to be able to still sustain the athletics and everything else that we needed to do and keep the pace. The school feels it's really important to be able to keep the pace of the calendar, to have students ready and on point at the end of a semester and at the end of the school year.
So people were not feeling raggedy at the end of the year as though they'd been playing catch up for months and months.
No, because, you know, I mean, and we have an AP curriculum in particular, one of the, you know, again, one of those deadlines that isn't going to be flexible and you know, just the sequential courses and things of that sort, an Algebra 1 to an Algebra 2 or those. And teachers did feel that if they were able to regain a feeling of wholeness in the classroom by not only having those minutes available to them, but also being able to take a look at some of the, I would say, ways that they could better teach. And that's another part of how we were able to utilize the actual experience that we had from the flood, was that teachers were able to reassess the ways that they taught certain concepts and units to see what ways they could actually do it maybe a little bit more efficiently and also more, I guess, strategically from a standpoint of the students' investment of time. Was it really worth some of the things that they had to do? And so they revalued those sorts of things.
Wow. Well, so looking kind of backward and forward at the same time. So what are the big lessons that you learned, that you have learned, and that Episcopal School learned as a school about keeping the academic program together, even while the world is in some chaos? I think, you know, you've talked about LMS, you've talked about emergency lesson plans, you've talked about, you know, being willing to lose the schedule, but you know, what should schools have in place to ready themselves as much as possible for the unexpected, regardless of maybe where they are, and the resources and assets in a school's community, what might be especially or surprisingly useful in keeping things going or jump starting after a disaster? It sounds as though somebody was able to get to ServPro quickly and get yourself to the top of their list. So what were the big surprises, negative and positive? I guess I also at this point would sort of add, you know, sort of thinking about kind of long-term issues. There was an article in USA Today about sort of mental health concerns relating to kids who had been in some of the disaster areas this year. So
Well, I have to say, Peter, I think the recent hurricanes, I can help speak to that also, that the problems we've had with some of our community, not just at our school, but also across the Baton Rouge community, watching other floods and other hurricanes has been very difficult. The stress that's resulted from it has even had it on TV, so we can talk to that. But I would say probably going back to your first question is that communication is vital, and the sensitive nature of the communication is important, because and it's pretty obvious very shortly into a disaster the value and meaning of the school to the family, to the community, and the interconnectedness of it all, that the faculty is an important component, but it's certainly not in having students and administration. But when it comes to the having, when you think about what it takes to educate a student at the school, there's so much respect that goes for anybody that's the groundkeepers and everybody that has their own part to being able to provide the learning environment, much less the actual learning itself. And I think you have to realize too, it's not just the stress after, let's say, the post-traumatic stress that's incurred, but I think also the fact of how much the school and the burden of the school, and to some extent, to how important it is in the community, much less to every family and to every child, that the importance of those sorts of experiences, especially in an independent school, because those families have wanted to invest in that ultimate experience. And so if it's threatened at that point, I mean, that's a maybe a feeling of uneasiness. But at the same time, what we were able to see is that the amount of energy that was the drive of people to be able to help, to come together in all levels, to be able to do it for the greater good of the student, to give each of those children that opportunity and to be able to bring them forward, and to not focus on the heartbreak that was all around at that point. Even our chaplain had such a magnificent influence over pacing us and trying to keep our stress. Each day he would send out a little meditation in the morning to talk about the sun rising and the work to be done. And at night he would send one back, another meditation that the sun is going down and it's time for us to rest, to be able to have energy to work the next day. Because people were so driven to work so hard to get their houses ready enough to be able to function, or to and also being able to get the school ready enough to be able to function. So I think the being ready for communication and the sensitive nature of it, that's something that I think you sort of, maybe that's not anticipated, but if there's a threat of a closure of more than a few days, it that becomes even more important in how you're able to keep people engaged and not too worried. The virtual aspects of things, again, with communication, even with lessons, it's at that point, I think it just brings people to understanding that there's face to face, but what is the school? Is it a way for us to unite the minds of people and the experiences of people? And so at that point, I think we've gained more respect for the virtual in some ways, is that from a standpoint of we need to use every resource, electrons, much less wires, to be able to, electrical wires and everything else, that we can be able to stick together and provide that type of experience. And again, if you're looking at it one day, you're looking at it a week, something less than a semester, something as great as a year, that what would you do depending on the level of all those experiences? And if you're threatened to close for a reasonable amount of time, more than a few days, there is that threat that you're not going to be able to get everybody back together. And with Hurricane Katrina, it was a reality that we couldn't pull everybody back together. And that city has continued to live a new life now as a result of it. the peace of mind of short-term alternatives, I think, are really important. I think that a school has the opportunity to live through minor closures, to be able to build the emotional intelligence to try to deal with the unpleasant thought of what if. And if we can have fire drills, why can't we have emergency learning drills? And Episcopal School of Baton Rouge took that challenge back a few years ago, and it was met, again, I think it was met well across the community from a standpoint of compared to adjusting a calendar, compared to lots of other things, having some sort of protocol, in particular for us, some virtual protocols, which we have now enhanced with, like how to do something with a sister school. Like, I don't know that we would call some of the schools our sister schools, other schools that cooperated with us to use their fields, okay, to be able to use their fields, to be able to, you know, do our athletics. That was as important to our academics as being able to have the whole school function and having students be whole and participate there. So the level at which that is done, I think it's somewhat important to think down the road. Schools and nursing homes in New Orleans in particular have taken those sorts of steps. That naturally happened after Hurricane Katrina. Some students were in classrooms in other schools across the United States. And that, even including Tulane University, became, I think, one of the first examples of how other institutions actually took in students. And knowing about course providers, Peter, again, this LMS thing, and our teachers are sure that they have at least 3 days of closure. Reality is, if you take a look at, probably there are some best practices that have been revealed after the H1N1 flu type of situation that emerged, that the CDC recommended 8 weeks of some sort of, and not necessarily a virtual, but having some sort of lesson management possibly for up to 8 weeks, because schools have been involved not just with storms, I mean, other disasters, medical disasters. I happened to be working with a teacher in Beijing during that flu crisis, and his school was closed for 3 months total because of the outbreaks that they had, and the Chinese government was very, very cautious about having another epidemic on their hands. And they were fortunate to have some learning management system up and running that they were able to keep things together at that point. But so how many weeks of lessons are you going to have ready, maybe? But what we're able to do now, because it's, you know, the year 2017, there are companies that provide or schools like the Florida Virtual School, the Virtual High School out of Massachusetts. There's a few vendors, K-12 Learning, there's Middlebury, there's quite a few online providers where you're able to actually get the content that's already made. It may not be as good as what your faculty would make, but you can get that particular content, and you have your own teachers. Well, if you have your own teachers and at least the start of that sort of thing, could you carry on for a few weeks, let's say a few months possibly, to be able to keep a school together that might be pulled apart by some sort of disaster? And I think that those days are here, and I think that sort of intelligence is possible, because by learning by the small closures and the fact that we have fires, we have floods, we have tornadoes. I mean, the number of natural disasters that have been happening more frequently lately, I think, have brought people to realize that we're not overreacting. Just like we're hoping to never have a fire in a school, but you still have to do fire drills.
Sure.
And I have to say, after seeing that New Orleans situation and the school closures that have resulted from Hurricane Katrina, it could definitely, a disaster can change the path of a school. if certain things aren't in place, in particular, like faculty contracts, you know, being able to hold faculty together, you know, if, and then what do you do about taking in tuition if you're not able to teach? So families are going to find education for their student. And if the school that they're at can provide it, if not, I think what we'll see, in, at least in what has happened in previous disasters, is that the students will migrate and be in a place or in a situation that can provide the learning. Example with Puerto Rico right now, a lot of those people are having to leave Puerto Rico and are going to Florida to educate their children, or at least children are leaving if they're not able to leave.
That's a really powerful lesson, and I think that what you just said about, you know, if there's parents will find education for their children, and both an opportunity and an obligation for our schools to be thinking about how to continue to provide that, regardless of what the physical circumstances might be. I think that's a super important lesson. Wow.
So I think the evacuation aspect of it adds to the drama and also adds to the reality of it. I mean, you know, fires, the number of evacuations that have to happen these days have become more intense, which causes displacement of students. And then I think I have to say in particular, for Episcopal School of Baton Rouge, the fact that they were able to unite and the school found unbelievable amounts of strength and community in the whole process of this flood. And at the same time, we've been very fortunate to have authors, in particular from StoryWorks. Our fifth grade teacher reached out, part of the stress that you had mentioned, and we were fortunate that one of the authors, Lauren Tarish, has a series of books that are related to disaster. And she has a very open to growth mindset about it, because she finds that if students can read about other these sorts of things, and you can see how people are show leadership and how people support and work together, that there is recovery, and that's the part that you have that you know that has to stay in the mind. It's a matter of finding the path to recovery. It's a matter of just doing those sorts of things, and that. We had the author visited our school, and our students helped her to write an actual story about the Great Flood of 2016, and they included a video, because at that time it was the worst U.S. disaster since Hurricane Sandy, and which had happened I think back in 2012. So. At that time in 16, and I think the thing about the Episcopal flood, in my opinion, from the levels of experiences I've had, it's a moderate disaster. And even in it, not to say that it took us many months. We were in a fragmented situation with classes to fix the school, to dry the school. Surf Pro prevented us from having to do some repairs that, you know, because they were able to help us dry faster, but we were, we had gyms down through, I guess it was like February of that, again, the flood in August. And so many months later, we were still, you know, fixing wooden floors and getting teams back on campus. So finding a path to recovery, and also realizing that the children, the students, the faculty, anybody that's been in it have been traumatized. There's a certain amount of trauma to it. And so being able to have lessons from it, like the story, and having resources like this, and having our counseling staff was very important to identifying the students who had been involved in the storm or the flood. Also, how many families had taken in other families. So, I mean, the combination of stress that our students were having going home and doing homework, even unusually so, with houses that were filled with people, dry houses were very filled with people, staying out late at practice. And so to be normal had a certain amount of abnormality to it, which again, I think is a common part of recovery from a disaster, being able to regain that real normal that comes with the continued work to get each of the individual pieces back together in the school, in the family, and also in the community, like with stoplights that are working, you know, having traffic flow through a city is also, and having buses, we did lose all of our buses also, which did make life a little bit more exciting. It took us over a year to get those. You know, we were able to, again, work through all the things that had to happen to get new buses. So we are up and running again, and feeling that, in a way, the flood for us is still here for our recovery. But at the same time, the strength that it gave and has given us to look at any other thing that has happened after it has given us, I guess, a game plan to being able to feel that we can take it step by step and be able to identify our path to getting everything back to exactly the way it needs to be.
Wow. Well, it takes a village, but sometimes it takes something larger to remind you of what your village really is and how complex and wonderful the village can be. Wow. So we need to end on an upbeat note. I think we are, actually, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about what's going on at Episcopal School of Baton Rouge these days around sort of teaching and learning. I'm also interested in the ideas, the books, thought leaders, other kinds of resources that have been keeping you all inspired and thinking forward when the floodwaters aren't rising. And who have you been reading, listening to, and what are the next steps at Episcopal School of Baton Rouge?
Well, Peter, I think, as you've stated, it's been... we've been able to utilize energy from the flood in moderation, of course. We were able to continue our accreditation, which was one of the goals that we had a spring visit in February. So somehow we were able to do it, but that was a dedication of the community to make sure that our strategic plan was ready to launch in a continual fashion as we've been doing. So, so right now we have more innovation happening across campus. That's been one of the major goals, is taking a look at personalization and being able to provide strategic faculty like our instigators. We have a lower school and a middle school instigator for creativity, math, and science that percolates around in an upper school, and also they percolate around campus and assist teachers with those types of lessons and things that they just wish they had the time to help pull together, and also they provide ideas of things that allow for the students to have more of a personalized experience in the classroom within project-based learning. Tends to be part of the toolkit that brings it forward, so that the students are able to get a little bit more than the traditional curriculum. One thing we were able to bring to campus this semester, we began working with New View Studio back in the spring of 2011, which is out of Cambridge. They work with Beaver Country Day. So we were able to have a relationship with them where we have one of their interns here with us, and we have been able to modify our schedule a little bit to be able to accommodate that studio approach of creativity learning here. And we've been able to integrate some service learning to it, which has been very exciting. Mm-hmm. And we've been looking at, in lieu of, again, the project-based learning and having more innovative approaches, we're looking at maybe a modified block schedule, taking a look at some scheduling changes, in particular in our upper school, and trying to have more choices for students, as many as possible, by looking at, in particular, like world language requirements and availability, using our middle school as high school credit courses when our students are ready for those high school level credits. And we've been having good luck, very good experiences with our math placements, and making sure students are, once they know their arithmetic, they're into algebra. We have a pretty good feeling now when we associate testing data with where students can be placed in math, which helps to clear things for them in upper school by having less units required. We have students going off campus, like with ALZAR, utilizing other resources that we can tap into, like a semester school like ALZAR, or our Episcopal students taking action in advanced science research, which we have students that go to university laboratories with the help of our instigator to help bridge what's happening between there. Because there's a little bit of a cultural learn that has to happen when you're in a university laboratory for like a year. Mm-hmm. We try to have an extended experience. And so if that's what works for those students, we're there. And we also have a debate, a group that's very robust. And we have a philolectic group that provides an amazing art, theater, and drama that we have. We're building some. We've had some reconstruction and renovation and some construction. So we started with our chapel for our spirit. We're having a STEM center, which we're calling an academic commons, mostly for math and science.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll be moving on to a field house for the body. So. So those are the, I guess, manifestation and learning space, and also with what's going on in those learning spaces.
Oh, I love the way you talk about the instigators. I think I can imagine listeners, you know, wishing, I want to be an instigator at that school. I want to be an instigator at my school. It's a wonderful designation for that role. Do people do the instigators are they given some release time to instigate?
Oh, they are totally instigators, Peter. I mean that's their job. I mean their position here is to they have no specific schedule. Now each of our instigators they happen to have a class that they're running in some capacity in where it seems to be that's the best use of it. But the instigators are they take seriously the fact that they're available across the campus and to the faculty, and they're working in the classrooms. They do have their own little they do have their own studio too, where they're able to take groups of students periodically and do things that way. But I think you've caught, we started with an instigator, I guess, in the fall of 2011, and we have had some teachers in the classroom that have definitely become a lot more instigator-esque. I think that's part of the inspiration. And I think the other thing that the instigator symbolizes at Episcopal is the fact that understanding how much it takes to take that extra step to be innovative, how much it takes to be able to pull off that new lesson that you really want to do, that we've been trying to provide at least a helping hand to being able to assist our faculty instead of layering on more burden to them and taking more of their energy in this direction of which we're trying to go.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I also like the way you were phrasing the way in which all of these things work together to support the idea of educating the whole child, body, spirit, mind, creativity, all of those things. That sounds wonderful. And we wish you guys all kinds of luck with all of this. Well, so Jewel, I just want to thank you so much for your time, and more importantly for the work you're doing at Episcopal School of Baton Rouge to really support, promote, and enact not just the school's mission, but our principles of independent curriculum, and frankly, to inspire us all, as this conversation has inspired me, to say, to be and stay strong and resourceful even when the world gets pretty weird and pretty scary. So again, just thank you so much.
You're welcome, Peter.
And so listeners, we will be posting Jewel Reuter's contact information at the Episcopal School of Baton Rouge, along with a précis of this podcast, so that those of you who have been engaged and inspired, as I have been, by this conversation, can follow up with your own questions, ideas, and resources. I think we all have a lot of thinking to do, and this has been a super helpful conversation in getting us to think about these things. So, thank you again, Jewel, and thank you, listeners. Thank you for listening to this Independent Curriculum Group Partner Podcast. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the ICG, hoping that you will listen to the entire ICG Partner Podcast series, and wishing you all the best in your own journey toward the future of education.